As we have seen with the current Ebola epidemic, one of the great concerns of today's interconnected world is that when people travel, when you travel, you bring your stuff with you. And not only the microscopic organs that cause human disease, but also the invasive species, you know, the stuff that gets stuck on the props of your boat or your rudder, stuff like that, and you take it with you, you go to the next lake. Well, here in the Great Lakes region, at least 186 hitchhiking species have arrived. You've got your zebra and your quagga mussels, your rusty crayfish and bloody red shrimp, and as for the Asian carp, you keeping track of that? Well, yeah, it's knocking on the Great Lakes door somewhere down in the Mississippi. My next guest is something of an invasive species detective because he uses DNA to track new arrivals and crunching numbers to see which potential invader could do the most harm. David Lodge is director of the Environmental Change Initiative here at the University of Notre Dame. Welcome. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Okay. How bad is it?
Well, if we think about it from a global scale, there are lots of advantages to globalization. As you mentioned, we can all traverse the globe more rapidly than we could. We have more and bigger planes, more and bigger ships. But there are some side effects of globalization that require better management if we're to fully realize the benefits of globalization. So as we do move around the planet, as you suggested, and bringing things with us, either intentionally or accidentally, we end up with some species that cause us great harm.
What do they do? What exactly is the harm that they cause?
Well, so in the United States, if we look at the United States as a whole, the best estimates suggest that the harms amount to on the order of $1,500 a household in the United States, a cost that's very similar to that of the Iraq War when it was in full swing. So these are harms that decrease agricultural production. Some weeds are invasive species from somewhere else that cause harm. They cause damage to human health, Ebola being the most timely example. They cause other harms to the economy. Zebra mussels that you mentioned plug up pipes. So there are all sorts of harms that some subset of these non-native species can do. And as you said, in the Great Lakes, we have at least 186 species, and our estimates are that's costing us $100 to $800 million a year just from shipborne invasive species in the Great Lakes.
And so you have some special DNA investigative tools to keep track of where these invasive species are going? And the kind of harm they're doing?
Yeah, I think that what we and many collaborators and I and other research groups have done is advance the science in recent years so that it would be possible, if the current science and technology were used fully, to really save ourselves from any of these harms. So we need to think in terms of preventing species from arriving in the first place. But when that fails, as too often is the case, we often are stuck with wondering, well, where is that Asian carp? Where are those species? How can we manage if we don't know where they are? So in order to manage well, you need to be able to measure where they are. So we're using DNA to do that.
How do you do that with DNA? Is there a trail of DNA breadcrumbs that you follow? Or it's hard to do that in the water, I know, but what happens?
It's a good analogy. We're doing is sort of the equivalent for environmental protection, what forensic scientists do every day at crime scenes. Indeed, we and every organism leaves a cloud of DNA behind us, if you will. And in the aquatic environment, where it's very difficult to directly observe organisms, that turns out to be a very sensitive tool to detecting the presence of an organism. So we just take a water sample and extract the DNA and look for that fragment of DNA that is the sort of fingerprint of the species we're looking for.
Hmm. And do you have to separate it out from all the other DNA that's in the water at
yes.
the same time?
Yes. So we, in the first version of this, which we pioneered here with many collaborators at Notre Dame, we did the first full-scale field trial with Asian carp as our target, and we extract all the DNA from a water sample. In this case, it was in the Chicago Canal. And then just look for the DNA that belongs to the species we're concerned about.
So let's say you take a teaspoon of water. How many different different types of DNA are in that one teaspoon?
Well, we've now moved on to sequencing all of the DNA so that we don't just need to look for one species, but now we can answer your question, and the answer is hundreds or thousands if you're looking for all, if you include all the microbes.
How do you know if a species is not here yet? How do you know that when it gets here, it's going to be trouble?
Well, so this gets to the most cost-effective way we can respond to this as a society is preventing things from getting here in the first place. And we and others have pioneered an approach that you might call species profiling. The approach is to provide an index of invasiveness or the likelihood with which a species is going to cause harm. And we do that by looking at the characteristics of species. And if we use history as our guide, what we've discovered is that the species that turn out to be harmful, that turn out to be invasive, actually have different sets of characteristics than those that will be benign. So we can use those now, and agencies are increasingly using those, including some national governments elsewhere in the world, to screen species that are proposed for importation and then gain the benefits of commerce, say in the horticulture trade or the pet trade, by allowing the species that won't cause harm to come into trade and only preventing or otherwise managing species that would be harmful.
How when the species get here, or invasive species get here, do they gang up against us, or do they use one another to help each other out? Is that a problem? Can they?
Sometimes that happens. There's no particular reason to expect that would always be the outcome, but the Great Lakes do provide some examples of that. So quagga mussels and zebra mussels are now consumed by round gobies and in the Great Lakes. Round gobies and quagga and zebra mussels coexist in their native range, and now they coexist in the Great Lakes. So they're all thriving together and in some cases exacerbating the problems that each would have caused individually.
Let's go. Do we have a question? Yes, we do have a question down here in the audience. Please don't be afraid. Come on down. What happens is no one wants to come down, then everybody wants to come down. We don't have time. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question back to the eDNA studies that you've been doing, and I'm curious if we're getting any closer to knowing if DNA is present in the water that you test. Does that mean the species is present right there? Would it be miles away? How long does the eDNA last in the environment? How close are we to getting some of those answers?
This was initially quite controversial because we didn't know the answers to many of those questions. But in the last couple of years, we have learned those answers through experiments and observations. And in general, we believe that when DNA is detected, it's quite a reliable indicator of the presence of a living organism nearby in the not-too-distant past. For example, the DNA we've discovered that under the normal conditions in surface waters where we sample them, it degrades, it becomes undetectable in a matter of hours to days after the organism, the fish, for example, is removed. So it's a signal that is almost real time.
I'm Ira Flatow talking with David Lodge, Director of Environmental Change Initiative here at the University of Notre Dame on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. What about a Native American species that might be invasive to other countries? Are there any like that come to mind? Are we exporting some species that are going abroad?
You know, I talked about globalization to begin with. This movement of species is very definitely a two-way street. We hear a lot in this country, not only in the Great Lakes region, about Asian species. Well, why is that? Because we have a lot of trade with Asia. The Chinese, on the other hand, are suffering a great deal from North American species because the trade is two-way. So their pine forests are being attacked by beetles from North America. They've got Louisiana crayfish eating their rice. They've got American bullfrogs. They've got all kinds of harmful species from North America.
All they need is their Mark Twain, and they've got everything from the South there. Thank you, David. It's been fascinating. David Lodge is Director of the Environmental Change Initiative here at the University of Notre Dame. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's about all the time we have. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Our production assistant is Becky Fogel, Rich Kim is our technical director, and Sarah Fishman is our engineer. And for everyone who couldn't join us at Notre Dame, not to worry. We've got a video of the event at our website, sciencefriday.com/Notre Dame. And a special shout out to the folks at WVPE, Tom Labaczynski, Anthony Hunt, Kim Macon, and Bob Henning. And our friends here at the University of Notre Dame, Dean Greg Crawford, Bill O'Hare, Marissa Gebhard, Tim Sexton, Amy Lehman, Denise Sullivan, and Doug Hildeman. And of course, Dan Stowe and the University of Notre Dame Glee Club. In South Bend, I'm Ira Flatow.